There are countless issues that we could cover when it comes to the FBI's involvement in the JFK assassination. For the purpose of our journey here in Season 3 of Solving JFK, the two big questions that we need to answer are whether the FBI had foreknowledge of the assassination in any way, and whether the FBI facilitated a cover-up of the assassination after the fact. And when I say the FBI, I pretty much mean J. Edgar Hoover. In this episode, we turn our attention to the FBI's investigation of the assassination. What did J. Edgar Hoover do in the immediate aftermath of President Kennedy's murder? What was Hoover's relationship like with the Warren Commission? And what was the ultimate role of J. Edgar Hoover, if any, in the murder of President Kennedy?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton. On November 22, 1963, shortly after J. Edgar Hoover returned to the FBI office from having lunch, he received a phone call from J. Gordon Shanklin, the special agent in charge of the Dallas FBI office. Shanklin told Hoover that the president had been shot. Hoover's first call after hearing this news was to Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, whose lunch meeting at his McLean, Virginia estate was interrupted by the news of his brother's death. Around 4 p.m. Eastern, after Lee Harvey Oswald was in the custody of the Dallas police, Hoover followed up with Bobby Kennedy to tell him, quote, "We have the man." While Hoover wasn't very specific with Bobby, it's notable that he would express such confidence that Oswald was the man just 3 hours after the president's death. That's because Hoover doesn't sound nearly as confident about Oswald's guilt when he talks to President Johnson on the phone the next day. Similarly, an FBI memo to President Johnson about Oswald's interrogation from that Friday afternoon concludes with, quote, "Present status, arrested in connection with killing of Dallas policeman. No direct link with assassination. Reported to be refusing to answer questions." On the Saturday morning after the assassination, Director Hoover called President Johnson. That call starts out with Hoover saying, quote, "I just wanted to let you know of a development which I think is very important in this case. This man in Dallas, we, of course, charged him with the murder of the president. The evidence that they have at the present time is not very, very strong." Later in the call, Hoover says, quote, "The case, as it stands now, isn't strong enough to be able to get a conviction." But the real headline about this phone call between the two former neighbors of 19 years is when Hoover says that someone impersonated Oswald in Mexico City. The relevant section goes as follows. President Johnson, "Have you established any more about the visit to the Soviet embassy in Mexico in September?" J. Edgar Hoover, "No, that's one angle that's very confusing for this reason. We have up here the tape and the photograph of the man who was at the Soviet embassy using Oswald's name. That picture and the tape do not correspond to this man's voice, nor to his appearance. In other words, it appears that it was a second person who was at the Soviet embassy down there." We previously covered Hoover's claim that there was an Oswald imposter in Mexico City in episode 54. Based on what Hoover's saying here in this phone call, the implications are that there's some sort of plot where Oswald is being made to look a certain way, which for almost anyone would be enough to establish that Oswald could not have acted alone, if at all. I mean, what kind of lone nut has someone impersonating them at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City? This phone call transcript is definitely on the list of the top documents that established there was a conspiracy. Now, the counterpoint against Hoover saying that Oswald was impersonated is that the audio tape of Oswald in Mexico City never actually made it to Dallas. Instead, the argument is that there were just transcripts of the tape. This is supported by a cablegram that was sent to Director Hoover by the FBI's legal attaché in Mexico City saying that only transcripts were taken to Dallas, no tapes. In further support of the official story, the committee did not interview any FBI agents who recalled hearing that tape in Dallas. On the other hand, as noted in episode 54, Hoover followed up this phone call to Johnson with a detailed 5-page memo about the FBI agents listening to the tape in Dallas. Hoover also wrote a memo to Secret Service Chief James Rowley saying the same thing. And there are two Warren Commission staffers, David Slauson and William Coleman, who are on the record saying that they listened to the tape months after the CIA said that it had been destroyed. I believe that there was a tape in Dallas because Hoover never changed his tune about it. There's no example on the record anywhere of Hoover walking back this statement about Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City. Instead, 7 weeks after this phone call to Johnson, Hoover wrote in the margin of an FBI memo about the CIA, quote, "Okay, but I hope you are not being taken in. I can't forget the CIA withholding the French espionage activities in the USA and the false story, R.E. Oswald's trip to Mexico, only to mention two instances of their double dealing." We just covered the story of the Oswald Mexico City tape that was played for FBI agents in Dallas. This tape allowed the FBI agents, who were there with Oswald in person, to reach the conclusion that the man on the tape was not Oswald. Let's get back to the phone call between Hoover and Johnson on the morning after the assassination, where Hoover made that claim. All that we have left from that phone call is a 3-page transcript. The phone call itself was recorded. Mysteriously, that recording is no longer available. Researcher Rex Bradford tried to get the original recording of this phone call from the LBJ Presidential Library. The LBJ Library provided Bradford with a cassette tape that had numerous calls on it, but the one call that he was looking for, the one between Hoover and Johnson on November 23rd, was missing. In the place where that call should have been was machine noise that sounded like static. Here's what's on the tape in the 14-minute section where the Hoover-Johnson call should be. There were 12 phone calls on the same side of the tape. The other 11 calls all sounded great, including the calls immediately before and immediately after the Hoover-Johnson call. When Rex Bradford asked the LBJ Library what was going on with this tape, they told him that the tape was inaudible. Bradford then pointed out that there's only one very important conversation that was inaudible, and the rest of the tape was fine. Almost 2 years after Bradford first raised the issue of the Hoover-Johnson call potentially being erased, The LBJ Library responded to Bradford as a result of pressure from other researchers. It turns out that the LBJ Library had previously commissioned a study on the exact issue that Bradford was asking about. In 1999, before Bradford even began asking about the tape, the LBJ Library had a professional analysis done by the Cutting Corporation, who often worked with the National Archives. The result of that study was that there was, quote, repetitive cyclical occurrence of very brief bursts of noise and word syllables at 6 to 7 second intervals, and that, quote, most likely the belt was intentionally erased by the bar magnet included in most models of the magnetic belt machines, but a small portion was missed. In other words, the LBJ Library hid the fact from Rex Bradford that a single conversation on the tape that he asked for had, in fact, been specifically erased on purpose. To their credit, the library did eventually come clean after Bradford's article was widely circulated. The big question for me on this phone call is whether there is additional information that was not captured in the transcript that was erased, or whether the transcript captures the entire conversation, and the destruction of the tape underlines just how important Hoover's statement was about Oswald being impersonated in Mexico City. On Sunday, November 24th, Jack Ruby shot and killed Lee Oswald on live television, fundamentally changing the nature of any investigation into the president's murder. After all, now that the prime suspect was dead, there would be no trial, and there would be no one to legally challenge the government's theory that Oswald acted alone. Deputy Attorney General Nicholas Katzenbach was loyal to his boss, Bobby Kennedy, but in the wake of his brother's sudden death, the Attorney General was effectively out of commission. This meant that Katzenbach would serve as RFK's stand-in for all matters related to the government's handling of the president's assassination. After phone calls with both Director Hoover and President Johnson on the evening of Sunday, November 24th, neither of which were recorded, Nicholas Katzenbach sat down to write what would later be known as the Katzenbach Memo. Remember, this is just hours after Ruby killed Oswald. The memo said, quote, "The public must be satisfied that Oswald was the assassin, that he did not have Confederates who are still at large, and that the evidence was such that he would have been convicted at trial. Speculation about Oswald's motivation ought to be cut off, and we should have some basis for rebutting the thought that this was a communist conspiracy, or as the Iron Curtain Press is saying, a right-wing conspiracy to blame it on the communists. Unfortunately, the facts on Oswald seem about too pat, too obvious. Marxist, Cuba, Russian wife, etc." Katzenbach concludes the memo with, quote, "We need something to head off public speculation or congressional hearings of the wrong sort." Director Hoover agreed. He told Johnson's aide, Walter Jenkins, that he shared Katzenbach's concern, quote, "In having something issued so we can convince the public that Oswald is the real assassin." Katzenbach was so focused on convicting Oswald in the court of public opinion that he set up a departmental task force in the DOJ to prepare counterarguments against any allegations that someone other than Oswald killed the president. With Katzenbach, I see an American institutionalist who was concerned about the image of the United States that was being portrayed abroad. He thought that the lack of certainty around who exactly was responsible for the assassination was something that needed to be proactively addressed, especially after Ruby killed Oswald. It's also true that President Johnson was strongly implying to several people, including Senator Russell and Chief Justice Earl Warren, that a thorough investigation of the facts may lead to a conspiracy between Oswald and the Soviets, which would likely result in a nuclear war. So while Katzenbach's memo articulating a need to convict Oswald in the mind of the public is understandable in that context, it's not the type of document that someone writes who's in pursuit of the objective truth. Hey everybody, Matt Crumpton here. When I'm not researching, writing, or recording, one of my favorite ways to relax is with federally legal THC from Mood.com. This stuff doesn't come from a lab. It's pesticide-free and grown on American farms. You can get 20% off your first order using the code JFK. One of my go-tos is the functional gummies from Mood.com. These gummies only take 15 minutes to feel the effects, and you can choose all kinds of different moods, from creativity to pain relief to just plain old relaxation. Everything comes right to your door and is discreetly labeled. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, you also get 20% off of your first order using code JFK. So head on over to Mood.com and find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. Remember, use code JFK for a 20% discount. President Johnson wanted the FBI to finish its report by Tuesday, November 26th, just 4 days after the assassination. Johnson's plan was to then have Robert Kennedy rubber stamp the FBI report. But LBJ's strategy ran into an obstacle on November 25th when the New York Times called for a presidential assassination commission. On the same day, The Washington Post was about to write a similar editorial. Here's President Johnson talking to Hoover on Monday the 25th about how to proceed with the investigation.
Two things. Apparently some lawyer and justice is lobbying with the Post because that's where the suggestion came from for this presidential commission, which we think would be very bad. Put it right in the White House, and we can't be checking up on every shooting spree in the country. But they've gone to the Post now to get them an editorial, and the Post is calling up saying they're going to run an editorial if we don't do things.
President Johnson's plan was to have two simultaneous but coordinated investigations by Hoover's FBI and the Texas Attorney General, Wagoner Carr. Johnson was absolutely against appointing a presidential committee. It's hard to not be taken aback by Johnson referring to the assassination of his predecessor just 3 days earlier as a shooting scrape.
We can't be checking up on every shooting spree in the country.
Johnson's point was that he didn't want to involve the White House in the investigation, but the way he talks about it is perhaps a window into what he really thought about President Kennedy. The next day, Hoover writes a memo to the FBI's General Investigative Division that says, quote, "Wrap up investigation. Seems to me we have the basic facts now. This change in positions by Hoover is disorienting. Hoover went from saying the evidence was not very, very strong on Saturday to telling his agents to stop investigating on Tuesday. And he made that leap without explaining his logic. There was no new smoking gun piece of evidence during that time. The only thing that changed in the case between Saturday the 23rd and Monday the 25th was that the alleged killer, Lee Harvey Oswald, had been gunned down by Ruby. On the same day that Hoover instructed agents to wrap up the investigation, Alan Belmont, who was the FBI's point man on the assassination, wrote about the purpose of the FBI's report. Belmont said, quote, "This report is to settle the dust insofar as Oswald and his activities are concerned, both from the standpoint that he is the man who assassinated the president and relative to Oswald himself and his activities and background, etc. The FBI's report was issued on December 5, 1963, only 2 weeks after the president's death. The report found that two bullets hit President Kennedy and one bullet hit Governor Connally. It completely ignored the bullet that hit the concrete near James Tague. The Bureau was aware of the Tague injury, but it didn't investigate it until August of 1964. As early as the day of the assassination, the FBI was focused on Oswald alone. On that day, a Richardson, Texas cop called the FBI Dallas office about a possible suspect who was a white supremacist. The FBI's file on this report from the day of the assassination says, quote, "Not necessary to cover as true suspect located." The day after the assassination, the FBI New Orleans office was directed to cease contacts with, quote, "informants and other sources with respect to bombing suspects, hate groups, and known racial extremists," and to instead focus on, quote, "Lee Harvey Oswald or anything possible on his background." On the same day, Director Hoover personally ordered the termination of all FBI contacts with Cuban sources. Hoover also ordered the FBI's Cuba section of the Domestic Intelligence Division to stop investigating Oswald's time in Mexico City. On the other hand, Hoover did ask Clark Anderson, the FBI's legal attaché in Mexico City, to investigate all aspects of, quote, "false Oswald sightings and possible Russian direction of the assassination." Hoover gave this order in response to a cablegram on November 25th from U.S. Ambassador to Mexico Thomas Mann that said Castro and maybe the Soviets paid Oswald to kill President Kennedy. The FBI's basic investigation was finished on November 26th, according to the head of the FBI's General Investigative Division, Alex Rosen. After that, Rosen characterized the FBI as, quote, "standing around with pockets open, waiting for evidence to drop in when it came to the JFK assassination." On Wednesday, November 27th, the FBI was solely focused on Lee Harvey Oswald. But there was still an open question as to whether Oswald had any help from the Cubans or the Soviets. Deputy Attorney General Katzenbach suggested that Director Hoover send someone from the FBI to go down to Mexico City with, quote, "all the facts." Warren Commission expert Gerald McKnight notes that sending an FBI agent to Mexico City with all the facts was Katzenbach's way of telling Hoover to make sure that everyone in the FBI understood that the agreed-upon plan was to focus on Oswald as a lone assassin, not to explore Oswald's other potential contacts. Hoover then sent Agent Lawrence Keenan to Mexico City to clarify, quote, "all the facts" with Ambassador Mann and CIA Station Chief Wynn Scott. On December 6th, the FBI learned that New Orleans Secret Service agent John Rice had been investigating Oswald's Fair Play for Cuba handbills. Rice had asked the New Orleans FBI for the name of the company where Oswald had those handbills printed. This resulted in the local FBI alerting Agent Joseph Sizu, the assistant to William Sullivan, about Agent Rice's investigation. The FBI then contacted Secret Service Chief James Rowley to tell John Rice to stand down, which Rice did. On December 12th, the FBI Washington office issued a memo ordering all agents to restrict communications to, quote, "information pertaining to Oswald and to allegations that a person or group had a specific connection with him in the assassination." We've talked about Hoover's initial reaction to the assassination, his conversations with President Johnson, And the FBI's limited investigation focused solely on Lee Harvey Oswald. But what was Hoover's relationship with the Warren Commission? On November 29th, President Johnson, who was reluctant to have a commission at all, ran the potential commissioners by J. Edgar Hoover.
Are you familiar with this proposed group that they're trying to put together on this study of your report and other things? Two from the House, two from the Senate, somebody in the court, a couple outsiders.
No, I haven't heard of that. I've seen the reports on this, on the Senate investigating committee that they've been talking about.
Yeah, well, we think if we don't have, I want to get by just with Deer filing your report.
I think it'd be very, very bad to have a rash of investigations.
Well, the only way we can stop them is probably to appoint a high level one to evaluate your report.
Yeah.
And put somebody that's pretty good on it from that I can select out of the government and tell the House and Senate not to go ahead with the investigation.
Yes.
Because we get up there and get a bunch of television going, and I thought it'd be bad.
It'd be a three-ring circus.
When President Johnson asks Hoover for his opinion on these potential commissioners, Hoover gives his full approval for everyone except for John McCloy, who Hoover viewed as a publicity hound. As we just heard from President Johnson, the motivation for forming the Warren Commission was not to seek the truth. It was instead to ensure that there were no other investigations. Since Johnson already knew that the FBI report's conclusion was that Oswald acted alone, he assumed that the Warren Commission would give it a rubber stamp of approval. Once the commission was formed, Hoover's relationship with it was often a rocky one. It started out with the FBI leaking its report to the press, presumably with Hoover's knowledge. Still, Hoover found common ground with Warren Commissioners Alan Dulles, Gerald Ford, and John McCloy. The four men saw eye to eye on many things, especially making sure that Warren Olney did not become the commission's chief counsel. Olney was a boat rocker who was loyal to Earl Warren and was known as someone who would tell the truth. Hoover disliked Olney because Olney had publicly challenged Hoover's contention that organized crime was not increasing, and because Olney was a strong supporter of the civil rights movement. As one FBI agent put it, quote, "Olney was the only guy who had the balls enough to stand up to Hoover." In an attempt to stop Olney from working on the commission, Hoover told the number three man at the FBI, Kartha DeLoach, to identify, quote, "a number of sources to confidentially brief the commissioners on why Olney was unfit for the job." This resulted in the chief counsel job going instead to J. Lee Rankin, the former United States Solicitor General who previously represented the FBI before the Supreme Court. Once the commission got started with its work, a few things its members said and did rubbed Hoover the wrong way. For example, when Earl Warren told the press that the FBI's report, which had been leaked, was in, quote, "skeletal form," and that the commission would need to examine the raw materials itself, Hoover wrote on the newspaper story, quote, "certainly a needless, dirty dig by the Chief Justice." In March of 1964, Commission Chief Counsel Rankin sent a list of detailed questions to the FBI about its relationship with Oswald. Hoover ordered his staff to make Rankin's request a top priority and respond to, quote, "these obviously loaded questions." Director Hoover didn't like to be in the dark about what was going on behind the doors of the committee. He knew that the Warren Commission's final report could make the FBI look bad. So Hoover had the FBI Crime Records Division prepare dossiers on each member of the commission and all of the commission staffers too. On top of that, Hoover enlisted the help of one of the commissioners, Gerald Ford, to keep the FBI in the loop about what the commission was up to, and Gerald Ford was happy to help keep Hoover in the loop. He even smuggled a copy of the commission's July 1964 version of their report to the FBI. So what was the ultimate role of J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI in the assassination of President Kennedy? There are three questions here. Was Hoover a conspirator? Did he have foreknowledge? And was he involved in a cover-up? On the first question, my conclusion is that Director Hoover was not involved in a plot to kill President Kennedy. Yes, Hoover had relationships with Lyndon Johnson, Clint Murchison, and several mafia figures, and Hoover personally despised John and Bobby Kennedy. But there's no evidence to draw a line to Hoover's involvement in any sort of plot. However, Agent Marvin Giesling, who turned off the flash on Oswald the day before it would have been triggered, is a person of interest. As noted in the last episode, Giesling's explanation for his actions makes no sense. Giesling never testified under oath to the Warren Commission or the HSCA. The still unknown question is whether someone else told Giesling to remove the flash or whether he did it on his own. As for the next question, did Hoover have foreknowledge of the assassination? I find the answer to be inconclusive. There are two FBI reports from informants tied to Santo Traficante and Carlos Marcello that say that there was going to be an attempt on President Kennedy's life in the South before the 1964 election. Hoover knew about these reports, but he failed to pass the information on to Bobby Kennedy or the Secret Service. Unlike author Mark North, I don't find Hoover's inaction on those two files to be an act of treason. After all, it wouldn't be the least bit surprising to hear some mafia guy say that he wanted to kill Kennedy when Kennedy was coming at him. That makes a lot of sense. The mere fact that some connected mafioso was running his mouth about killing the president isn't the same thing as knowing that it's going to happen. Nevertheless, Hoover was probably grossly negligent for not passing those two threats onto the Secret Service. Finally, the last question. Was J. Edgar Hoover involved in a cover-up of the assassination? For me, the answer to this question is undeniably yes. Hoover, with the assistance of President Johnson and to some extent Nicholas Katzenbach, was crucial in orchestrating the cover-up of President Kennedy's assassination. Remember, on November 23rd, Hoover point-blank tells President Johnson that Oswald was impersonated at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. This wasn't a misunderstanding. Hoover's Oswald impersonation claim was supported by multiple memos and never retracted by Hoover. To the contrary, Hoover later wrote about the CIA's double dealing and false story about Oswald in Mexico City. This tells me that Hoover had knowledge that Oswald was impersonated, which means that he likely knew that the CIA was behind the impersonation. Notably, the Oswald imposter topic was never raised again after the November 23rd phone call with Johnson. In that same Saturday phone call with Johnson, Hoover says that the evidence is not very, very strong against Oswald. Yet Hoover also instructs the FBI to focus on Oswald as the sole assassin as early as the day of the assassination. It seems at this point in the case, on Saturday, November 23rd, when Oswald was still alive, Hoover was open to finding out more about Oswald's ties to other conspirators, especially the Mexico City angle. After Oswald was killed by Ruby, Hoover immediately got on board with Katzenbach and Johnson's idea to stop emphasizing the connections between Oswald and the Soviets and Cubans, which, as Johnson had warned, could lead to a nuclear war, and instead to have a razor-sharp focus on Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone nut. Of course, the question is, why would Hoover cover it up? Yes, Hoover liked Johnson, and he hated the Kennedys. Maybe that was some small part of his motivation. Knowing what we do about Hoover, a likely possibility is that he still desperately wanted a presidential exemption from his upcoming mandatory retirement. Hoover knew that working with his old friend Lyndon Johnson, he probably would get that exemption. And sure enough, in May of 1964, shortly before Hoover testified to the Warren Commission, President Johnson issued an executive order giving Hoover an exemption from mandatory retirement. Another possible motive for Hoover's cover-up would be to hide FBI mistakes from the world so that the agency Hoover worked his entire life to build would not completely lose credibility. This is especially true when it comes to the actions of Marvin Giesling. Hoover could see the writing on the wall. He could either work against his longtime friend, who was now the president, and potentially lose everything that he worked for his entire life, or Hoover could get in line with President Johnson and eventually the Warren Commission and execute the plan outlined by Katzenbach to paint Lee Harvey Oswald as a lone gunman. Next time on Solving JFK, we'll have a recap and rebuttals episode on Hoover and the FBI, and after that, we turn our attention to President Lyndon Johnson. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
I'm getting